Ahoy, Vachon. How's the French say, Vachon? This is the Brown Briefly, where less is more, more or less, coming to you live over KVSH 101.9 FM, Voice of Vachon, your island connection. Please make us part of your day. And be advised that our assertions and views, which can modestly be described as progressive persuasion, do not in any way reflect the opinions of KVSH or Voice of Vachon.
And that was Brian Brown, Brown Briefly founder and master of mirth and merriment, who could always find a bright spot, even on the darkest of days. This is Tuesday, June 23rd, 2020, in the year of the tweet. Pretty anemic tweet there, but it's the year of the tweet. The year of a global pandemic.
I'm working on it.
And the year of social unrest not seen since the 1960s. We're giving Truman a workout on all these sound
effects. I got him.
I'm going to bring my fart machine to these meetings.
That's right. So,
can I say that online?
Yeah, I guess you can since you just did.
So all of these certainly qualify us as needing bright spots in our day. Today, in the Gene Bosch studio, in the relative calm and security of downtown Vachon, we find mood-modulating synthesizer and chief zoomologist, who needs an autopilot airline captain and steady-handed sound engineer, Truman O'Brien.
Thank you. Thank you for that intro. That was very nice. Yes.
Next, let's recognize the new steely-eyed vision of Lynn Kerrigan, poet.
That's right. Mark,
relocated from the land of magnolias to the island of madronas, and our analytic academic, social worker, musician, activist, and former all-star shortstop for the Dixie Debutantes.
I like this. If y'all keep introducing me, pretty soon I'll be playing in the World Series. It just goes on and on. I'm just letting you embellish all that. It's fine with
and
me.
We'll be able to say, we knew her when.
That's right.
That's right. And anybody that wants to coach a little softball league or play a little softball game, I'm in. Can't we do that 6 feet apart?
Except when you're on base. Another welcome sight in our Zoom screens. 3 weeks beyond pure gardening immersion is organic sound effects master, singer, thespian, half a bubble shy of plum, but knows more ways to swing a hammer than most mortal men, carpenter Michael Shook, also known as Chauncey Gardner. Welcome.
Good morning. Good morning.
Good morning.
And thank you for that gracious introduction. I'm looking forward to this today. We have tons to talk about.
We do. Gracing us with both his Zoom image and his telephone voice is editor of Indivisible Vachon's weekly publication, For Your Consideration, Kevin Jones, who is finding far too many ways to stay busy during our imposed stay-at-home, stay-safe regime. What is on Indivisible Vachon's calendar for the week, Kevin?
Oh, we're not hearing you, Kevin.
Maybe that's better.
There we go.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, sir.
Okay, wonderful. We are writing letters. We are sending text messages. We are making phone calls. There's women of color running for our state legislature. We're lining up to support their campaigns. I'm just wrapping up 120 postcards to Iowa, and my writing hand is took a breath for last night, and we'll be at it again today. So yeah, we're doing a lot.
Sounds good, Kevin. And it's all work that needs to be done, for sure. So along with us, along with Truman and the voice of Vachon, Gene Bosch downtown studio, is Susan McCabe, master of dialogue, political activist, observer of truth, arbiter of insights, and host to the important and discerning conversations we all really need to hear on Real Talk. What will you be bringing to our attention today, Susan?
I am a techno dweeb as well. We have some technical difficulties going on here at the studio. However, I am pleased to announce that I will be hosting a one-hour special at noon today about mass incarceration and its impact on Black Lives Matter.
Susan, can I ask a question about that? Are you also looking into the prisons for profit industry?
There's a lot to be covered in this topic, Lynn, and the folks that I have are really specialists in the school to prison pipeline, the prison population efforts at decarceration and defunding police, that kind of thing. So it may come up, but I can't promise that.
Yeah.
Good. Thanks, Susan. Looking forward to it. And finally, I'm historian Bruce Hallman. We have a lot to talk about this week, lots going on. So let's begin with, does anyone have insights from Mr. Trump's disastrous Tulsa rally? I was heartened by the sea of blue seats that sort of confronted him. Must have been creation on their part to have blue seats rather than red seats. Is this an indication that the TikTok and K generation are ready for action?
Looks to me like they're taking action. And I thought it was incredibly clever.
You know, I am wondering, though. I think it's a combination of things. I mean, I know the kids did a, it's an amazing thing, but I kind of think he's losing steam. Did you look at the, boy, you look at the audience when the camera panned around? Man, people were bored. They were sitting there with their arms crossed. They were reading their phones. They were, you know, picking their nose. I don't know. They just didn't look like his normal enthusiastic crowd. So I'm kind of wondering if the roses or the bloom is off the rose, as they say.
I wonder how many were paid to be there.
How many were paid to be there?
It'll be interesting to see what happens today in Arizona. Kevin?
I agree. It's a sort of an evolving thing, and you know, he clearly has credentials as a entertainer personality. Although I have to, as bragging rights, I never ever saw any TV show, The Apprentice, during its entire run. So I'm happy to be able to claim that. But yeah, I do think that, you know, there's a lot about new that rings for people, that resonates for people. And I just think it's old now, and he doesn't have any new content. It's just all the same complaints and gripes and woe is him. And I think I'm thinking people are ready to move on to something that's really going to be beneficial, you know, for the country.
Well, and it was pretty outrageous to be expecting people to turn up for a big mass rally in the sight of an area that has increasing COVID cases. That was just arrogance at its height to me.
That's a good point, Lynn. I was going to mention that I think even in spite of the fact that Oklahoma has been deep red state for a long time, when something like this COVID pandemic has gone on as long as it has, even if you're really politically charged up about Trump still, I think there's a fair number of people that may, I don't know, but may have looked at the virus contagion and thought, supposedly it's safe, but I'm, as you brought up last week, Kevin, I'm being asked to sign a waiver of liability. This does not point to a good situation, and I think probably that contributed to it. And then, of course, the tickets that were ordered by the TikTok folks, that concerns me a little bit, because that can be turned any number of different ways. I mean, it's kind of cool because it worked. If you're a liberal progressive person, oh, wow, that's great. Now, what if Russian operatives pull that kind of stuff again? Disinformation and misleading things, that then it's not so great.
You just burst my bubble.
Yeah, that can definitely be used both ways, so we'll see. But somebody who pointed out to me I had actually heard about, you know, the, quote, liberals buying up the tickets, and then the day after the rally, a friend of mine emailed me and not only talked about the 6,200, I think, people who actually got clocked into the arena, but the work that, you know, TikTok and the other folks had done. He pointed out that, you know, the staffers now are going to have to go through a huge list of names trying to find real voters that they can connect with. And I thought, yeah, I should, the next rally, I should buy some tickets for like Stu Pid and maybe another few folks, friends of mine like that, you know, just for the heck of it.
Stu Pid. I like that. That's short for Stuart.
I will say, you know, Lynn, I think you raised a really interesting question about, you know, the effect of the virus and on attendance. And interestingly, I saw a little footage this morning of the folks gathering for the Arizona rally. And the cameraman said, hey, take a pan of the crowd here. And there might have been one mask.
Wow.
So it'll be interesting. I think somebody else mentioned, you know, we'll see what Arizona tells us. But yeah, it'd be interesting to weigh the coronavirus fear versus is there just a lack of enthusiasm at this point.
Have you seen the blurb that the two pastors from the church that he's going to be going to? Have you seen that? How they have this wonderful new invention that's going to clean the air. Well, it's ionization, and 99.9% of all the bugs are going to be killed in the air. Though they had Anthony Fauci on the other day saying, forget it. You're sitting next to somebody and they cough. It doesn't matter what you're doing with the air. If they've got it, you got it. You know, I mean, it was like, this is absolutely ridiculous, this whole
scuba
thing.
Scuba gear.
Maybe full helmet or something, you know, I don't know. But anyway, I thought that was interesting. That's why they're saying it's going to be safe to go.
Maybe Biden will run on like a respirator in every house or something like that. Yeah. Make sure we're all safe.
Chicken in every pot and a respirator in every house.
Exactly.
Exactly. Yeah.
So I noticed I get the daily sort of situation report from Vashon Be Prepared and the Emergency Operations Center. And yesterday's situation report announced that Vashon's COVID cases increased by 75%. Now that's from 4 to 7. So the numbers are still pretty low, but the trend line is disturbing. Any reactions to that?
I think it's foreigners coming on the island.
Darn foreigners.
That's right.
We are starting to open up a bit. You know, the restaurants are starting to have people in, and, you know, so the possibility is there. Even though there's a lot of outdoor seating and that sort of thing, we're still starting to open up. So,
are more people getting tested? I've gotten several notices lately that if you feel it necessary, it's possible to get tested now. And in much more brisk fashion than even a month or 6 weeks ago.
Well, one of the things they're doing is I don't know if you saw the folks out on the intersection the other day with the giant nose and the giant swab. That was kind of clever, but that was the emergency, or that was the Medical Reserve Corps that was doing that. And they're saying that you can call between the hours of 9 and 6 this particular number. And if you really are concerned that you might, you know, need to be tested, they first want you to go through your personal physician, of course, to get a recommendation. But if you don't have a doctor or whatever, you can call them directly. So.
And Michael, I think one of the things that I've been reading is that, yes, the amount of testing is going up.
Yeah.
But what they're looking at to see about it's increased incidence of the virus is they're looking at the test positive rates and the hospitalization rates, because that is the only indication really of the difference between just mass testing and whether the virus is continuing to take hold in other places. And it is going up in a lot of 23 states.
Yeah, and that's something I think Trump doesn't really understand, you know, when he talks about, well, maybe we should suppress the number of tests. You know, it's just, it's sort of like, you know, you want to increase the testing and you want to look at that rate, you know, that testing rate in terms of, yeah, just because you're testing more doesn't mean that the number of infections going up. It's percentage of infections per test. And so it's a complex kind of equation to look at. Not that complex, but for our president, sort of beyond his ability.
Clearly, it's too much for him to understand and or to allow him to keep his head in the sand.
Which was, I think, what flashed through my mind, and Cynthia mentioned it too, and when he was talking about less testing and everything, and what came to mind was just that. Oh, okay, so let's all put our heads in the sand here and pretend, and maybe when we lift our heads out, it'll all be okay. And I just...
You know, if we put our head in the sand for 2 weeks, it would slow the... you're on to something, Michael. I think we should all put our head in the sand for 2 weeks, and then we'll be good.
Yeah, maybe in the water, it, you know...
It does,
you know,
it does reiterate to me as we see these things spike. I know in Florida we had the hordes of people going to the beaches, and a lot of young people were, I mean, I know if you'd have told me something when I was 25, it's like, well, other people get sick but not me because I'm invulnerable, and we're seeing these numbers spike, and to me it's really hammering home, this is a long haul. This is just going to be a long haul.
I saw an interview with a father and son recently, and they both had COVID, and the son was in his 20s and his father was, I don't know, 60s or whatever. And the son was saying, he was saying exactly that. Oh, you know, I didn't think it was going to affect me. You know, I'm so young and blah, blah, blah. He said, listen, folks, this is real. I mean, it just about took them both out. So anyway, Lynn, go ahead.
I think I have such mixed feelings about all this because I am a public health by background person. I agree with their measures. And yet, personally, I am beginning to fray. And I'm seeing the life force come back in ways that aren't going to help people. You know, the teenagers... job is to bond and to form their own generation and to mate and to learn about sex and their identities in different risky circumstances. That's what it's about. We are not going to suppress that 100%. We're not going to suppress grandparents wanting to see their grandkids. We're not going to suppress it because we need endorphins and neurotransmitters and oxytocin and all of those chemicals that come from interaction and human contact. And I think what to me this is, it's kind of a race between these two competing factors that are happening right now. How much can we let reason determine our actions regarding the safety of ourselves and our families? And how much are we going to let the life force kind of take over and let us live halfway normal lives as soon as we can? I think it's normal and natural to be going that way.
It's interesting you point that out. You know, is it what, 1918, 1917, the flu that took so many lives? You know, today, you know, we have lots and lots of ways to stay connected, right? We're connected right now. At that time, there wasn't all of these electronic means to stay connected. So from a historic perspective, I wonder if people had more sort of emotional distress because of that. Just kind of think the point you're making, Lynn, is that that's a consequence, right, that we have to deal with as well. But I wonder if it was more acute, more severe.
There was a really good article in the New Yorker. I'm blurting out and talking over you, but to let you know that has been looked at a little bit. And then the pandemic in 1918, there were an enormous number of suicides because men in particular didn't feel like they had worth or the means to provide for their families. They were devastated. The economy was devastated. And I think you're right that it was extremely severe, and it wasn't the talk generation. You know, we can talk ourselves through and out of anything and into things. But I think that was a quieter generation, and they were more isolated, and they did suffer tremendously.
Susan.
Yeah, I don't think we're so far from that right now. I think men particularly gauge their value by whether they can bring in money. And particularly here in the Pacific Northwest, my fear is that if we continue through the fall and the winter when it's dark, our suicide rate is going to climb. It's really, how long can we hold out with this? And how many endorphins can we get from a screen?
Yeah, and you know, this certainly, there's, you know, what we're talking about are the consequences, right, of this pandemic, and what actions we take and so on. But you know, I've listened to people, of course, try to make the argument that, well, you know, there's a vulnerable part of society. If we kept those folks in, the other less vulnerable could go out. The disease would eventually wash. Well, we have, you know, we're heading for 200,000 fatalities, right? So, in my mind, yeah, there's definitely consequences, but the most severe is the one where you put yourself at risk. Because until we have a vaccine or some other ways to protect us, you know, even though the numbers might look better, and if nationally they're not, right, but in Washington maybe they're looking a little bit better, you know, we have no improved protection. I think we have to keep that in mind. And the folks that I hear talking about, you know, oh, well, maybe, you know, why are you out here without a mask? Right? And they say, well, you know, I might get COVID, I might get hit by a truck. But you don't see those people walking around on the freeway at night without a flashlight in high traffic, right?
They're not an analogy.
I mean, but humans are great at rationalizing what they want to do and ignoring the risks, because we're not very good risk managers usually. And I think we need to be aware that this is a risk, and it's something we need to be really take seriously, or we're going to see, you know, another bunch of cases here and across the country.
And the thing that bothers me about more than anything is not getting it, like me getting it, but me giving it to somebody else. I mean, I think that's the whole key to the thing. You know, these kids are saying, oh, I'm not worried about me. I'm 25, you know, I'll survive, whatever. Well, yeah, but how about your dad? You know, how about your grandpa that your grandmother that you're visiting? You know,
you know, the only other way out of this is to have enough tests available that every single person can get tested, and every single person that is infected needs to quarantine.
Yeah.
That is what will help eliminate this and knock it down. And I personally, as an older person, do not intend to be quarantined for the next year. I don't care if I get sick. Now, that seems counterintuitive, or it seems, you know, it seems subversive. But if I were to be honest, I would be saying just what I said, that I think that human nature has more need to congregate than it does to be safe. And I say that after years of a social worker experience where doctors inevitably want to put people, older people that are somewhat or temporarily disabled, into nursing homes. And they say that like it rolls like honey off their tongue. And 100% of people would, that's the last thing they want. It's the last thing they want to pay for. They feel like it's the last road, you know, of life, and nobody wants to go there before they absolutely have to. So I'm just saying that we have kind of a race between our reason and our need for human interaction. And I don't think I could go a year without seeing my kids, my grandkids. I don't care what the costs would be. I don't want to make them sick. That's, you know, what kind of, Truman, what you said, you know, it's easier for me to think about getting sick and dying than it is of me bringing something to those kids. If anything were to stop me, it would be that.
Susan.
I have some questions and confusions about the whole notion of this herd immunity idea. Does it mean that a number of us have to get it in order to create the antibodies and or reduce the number of available hosts for the virus. So if we open things up and more of us catch it, will we then move toward herd immunity before we can get a vaccine? And of course, how many people would we lose in that process?
That's the key.
Yeah.
Kevin?
I have some comments on that. So my understanding of herd immunity is that, you know, you're basing that, first of all, on a premise that once you have been infected, you develop an immunity. Science isn't really certain about whether that is true, number one.
True.
But if we grant them that, then the second thing is that if we're five of us, you know, if all of us are sitting in a room and, you know, four of us have had the virus, then there's only, and I come in infected, there's only one other person who's going to catch it, right? Because all four of you who've had it, you're immune. So I can only pass it on to one other person. But without herd immunity and without, you know, a virus, or I'm sorry, without a vaccine, say we're unprotected, you know, as many as, you know, each one of you could catch it. So in other words, there's lots of ways to slow the transmission of a disease, one of which is by, you know, covering your face, one of which is by staying home, one of which is that the people you contact are already immune, and so you can't transmit it. So that's my understanding. Now, I will also say, I think we have, what, 2 million cases or so in the United States right now of coronavirus out of 370 million people. So it's about, what, 0.5% right now of the population that's had it. And you think about, we have now 120,000 deaths. So multiply that by 50. In other words, since only 2% of the population's had it, we might have, what, 5 million dead people by the time we're done. I have to do the math. But yeah, I mean, I think the consequences are really severe if we just go the herd immunity route.
Well, it's Darwin. You know, I mean, you're gonna wipe out those folks who are susceptible, and so they're out of the population, and there you go. So if you want to have herd immunity, just wipe out 5 million people. And, well, and we'll be there, you know.
And it's a lot more than 5 million.
I mean, I know. I'm just using his number.
Between 4 and 6%. So right. What's say 5%? What's 5% of 360
million
people?
60
you know,
million.
You're talking about 18, 20 million deaths.
Yeah.
You know, so we can get herd immunity, but is the cost worth it?
Exactly.
Not if you're one of those 20 million.
Yeah. If you're one that survives, maybe. But.
Yeah, right.
Well, and that's why I keep going back to this notion that, you know, we can choose the degree of personal responsibility that we bring to the situation. And each one of us has our own vulnerabilities. We already, I think, Truman, you already mentioned it, that, you know, there's not only the consequence to us as an individual, but the consequence to the others that we're around. Mm-hmm. And so I just think about personal responsibility right now is really important. And I will say people should not be selfish. People should be aware and concerned of others. And I think that's the only way that we're going to get through this. Unfortunately, our current leadership doesn't share that concern, given the actions that they're taking. And so it's really incumbent upon us to take personal responsibility.
One thing I wanted to mention, someone mentioned the stress that's on our population and what's affecting them. I'm thinking of my nephew in particular. I have a nephew who's just turned 50, 51 maybe. He's, you know, gainful, can't say it. He's employed. and the poor guy is working himself to death. And what they're doing is they're working from home, but he's working 5:30 in the morning till 6:30 at night, you know, in his little office on the computer and on Zoom and, you know, everything else. And the stress that fellow's under is tremendous. And, you know, how long can these guys go? I mean, his company is talking about keeping it this way for a while. And what's going to be the effect of that over time? You know, I'm with you, Lynn. I mean, this is a really a serious
besides the people getting sick, those folks that are continuing, it's a huge deal. I don't know where we're going to go with it.
People with kids that are school age are going wild right now because they're hearing about the possibility of another full year online.
Yeah.
If not solely online, partially online.
Yeah.
And, you know, my daughter and son-in-law are both working from home and, you know, they're looking for camps and all of that stuff for the summer, but it's going to be tough.
Yeah,
and, camps are closing,
I think,
too.
To me, what I'm going to say is there's two things going on. There's the pandemic and there's what's happening with our economy and the social disorder, the civil disorder that is happening because so much of the responsibility for people to be working essential jobs is falling on, you know, a very small percentage of the population. And, you know, heroically, they are going to work. It's stunning to me how much responsibility is being borne by so few.
So let me,
and, you know, it's interesting. I heard a report from, I'm sorry, go ahead, please.
Oh, let me change gears here a second. Let's look at the larger picture here in terms of what's not only going on with COVID, but what's going on internationally with these sort of worldwide protests against racism, police use of force. Is this a sea change that we see going on? Is this a change in social attitudes, or is this going to fade away as the pandemic fades?
Well, I feel as I've examined that question in the today, and Cynthia and I have had a lot of discussions around this, and I think so many people around the world in this country and also in all other nations, almost all other nations, the middle class, the working class, the poor people, the working poor, and people of color are certainly bear the brunt of that, of being in the working poor. And I think when people's backs have been pushed against the wall for so long and for so many years, I think maybe the virus and the lockdowns and the losing what this incredibly tenuous grip that folks had on being able to make a living, to lose that now on top of everything else, I think really is kind of the straw that has just broken the thing wide open. And people are demanding not only racial justice, but a living wage, for God's sake. You know, in this country, I know in the carpenter's trade and all, blue collar trades, the wages have been almost dead stagnant since about 1975. There's been, adjusted for inflation, maybe a 1%, 1.5% increase in actual income. And people just can't take it anymore.
Susan?
You know, this is sort of tongue in cheek, but this situation has made me think a lot about Marie Antoinette and the French Revolution. And then I recently learned that the French Revolution was promulgated by the middle class, and we're losing our middle class. So who is going to stand up to the 1% who are taking all the profits and keeping wages low and making the middle class and the poor into pawns for their greed? It's really way out of hand and astounding in so many ways. So my question is, where is the real revolution going to come from?
It was interesting. If you saw the Seattle Times this morning, there's a guest editorial by Chip Hanauer, who's a...
Nick Hanauer, his son.
Right, yeah. About, you know, Washington State confronting this sort of budget crisis and essentially saying, you need to tax the one percenters. And he's one of the one percenters. And so it's interesting to see, for me to see how widespread this sort of recognition of a need for not only racial justice, but social justice and environmental justice has come together in a very powerful movement at this moment. And I think the pandemic's sort of part of that.
Who knows what's going to happen? I'm actually very happy that the people who had the most to lose, the blacks, have really stood up and demonstrated how to say enough is enough. You know, the whole social media documentation of what has been happening to blacks has also fueled, you know, this whole revolution. And boy, I cannot imagine how this is all going to land. You know, what parts of our society will want to retain and who will be left to make those decisions. Be interesting.
Let me interject here, Kevin, real quick, just a couple of hard numbers, Bruce, because here's that editorial. Lacking an income tax, Washington has the most upside down tax system in the nation. If you are poor or middle class in Washington state, you devote between 9 and 18% of your income to state taxes. Those of us in the top 0.01%, next to nothing. Wow. And that's just insane. We're talking about people whose annual income is, you know, over $1 million a year or some crazy thing like that.
Go ahead, Kevin.
And along those lines, interesting to see how this will play out. But you mentioned the Hanauer family. I was talking to Senator Mona Das just last week. She, by the way, is one of our member of color caucus in Washington state, of which our own Senator Wynn, of course, is also a member. She mentioned the fundraising that they're doing right now and focusing on candidates of color, because I support the theory that when lawmakers are people of color, they're more likely to stand up and make change that supports people of color, as opposed to folks who don't really understand and haven't really walked or lived that life. So she mentioned that she was shocked that the Hanauer family had donated and Jeff Bezos had donated to these causes, you know, to these candidates. So it could very well be that we're starting to see, you know, some of the 1% recognize that we really need to change the system. When I talked to Senator Das, and the question is, what is your primary legislative priorities at the 2021 state legislative session, given this global now awareness, right, of the systemic issues we have? She mentioned progressive revenue, which is essentially, right, to change our tax structure in the state of Washington. So it'll be quite interesting. There's more to be done. The Members of Color Caucus sent a open letter to the people of Washington state. You can find it on the Members of Color Caucus website about the fact that they are focusing on police brutality as well as equity. And so they're open to hearing from the communities about where the needs really are so that they can move forward. So it'll be fascinating to me to see how that plays out in the 2021 session.
So my question is, I mean, I understand that, you know, we're one of the few states without an income tax. Since we do have such an incredibly large sales tax, how are they going to reduce the sales tax and increase, you know, if they institute an income tax, then are we going to be paying both? Are we going to reduce one, or how are they going to do that?
Can I respond for a second? Because sure. Some time ago, and I would say it was maybe 5 or 8 years ago, so several elections ago, Bill Gates Sr. put out quite the paper on progressive tax reform for Washington State. I would urge anybody who wants to see a deep dive into what we could do to read his report. It was a big commissioned study, and Truman, I'm 99.9% sure that, of course, there's going to be theoretically, you know, an adjustment to the sales tax if we get an income tax, because that would be the purpose, to make our tax situation more equitable, especially in downturn times when people aren't buying anything. you know, so now the state is in terrible budget trouble again, and we're going to be looking at a bad next year.
Kevin?
You know, most of the proposals that I hear are about capital gains taxes and targeted taxation to the 1%, right? Or maybe the top 5%. So in other words, the likelihood that we would see any increased taxation through a progressive revenue proposal, although I have not looked to see what they're proposing, they may not have a proposal currently, but I think it is targeted to a group of folks who are well beyond, you know, well beyond our income levels, is my guess.
You know,
what happens over time, you know, we'll see, but that's my understanding.
I hate to be the... and take the opposite view here, but you know, it's the old camel's nose under the tent. Once you start, you know, it's going to get everybody. I'm sorry.
And there's the thing that I think why citizens of Washington, what I've read, have balked so much at this. And being someone who earned his living my entire life working for dairy farmers and small logging outfits, small manufacturing, small carpentry companies, that tax burden, the way our tax is structured in this state, is just awful for them. A company like Boeing can deal with the B&O taxes pretty easily because they got a whole division that's devoted to nothing but doing that. But if you're running a plumbing company and you got five employees or something, the B&O tax, you're taxed on your gross, not on your actual profit, which is the stupidest thing I've ever heard of. And it's hard to convey the antipathy that small contractors feel towards that tax setup. And then you put the sales tax on top of it, and it's just like, no way are they going to go for anything else.
Yeah.
In my dream world, the sales tax is abolished. The B&O tax is completely restructured. So it's on your actual income, your net profit. And then the door might be open to an income tax.
Well, let me just say one other thing that I learned this week in talking to a woman who has participated in what's called the Racial Equity Group, which is a group that meets once a week during session, and it's by invitation only, and they don't invite people who look like me. It's really groups that are impacted by social injustice. And the theme that came through their conversation with the legislature is, you know, we're just not going to get a lot of legislators who are going to push for improving mental health funding or improving social services funding. Because, you know, with our tax structure, we can't pay for it. And there's no legislator who wants to stand up and advocate for a system change that we just fundamentally can't pay for. So what that framing says that this issue is really a cornerstone that's blocking our progress in these other things that we say that we want. So how that plays out again will be very interesting, but I believe that relationship makes sense to me. So we'll see.
Well, folks, we're
great insight.
Kevin. We have about 10 seconds here to go, and
solving the problems of the world once again.
We'll look at it next week again. Thanks, guys.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.